Here is a new way to listen to KPFT on any smartphone, Android, or Apple. KPFT Houston, the appropriate destination for your ears.
Hi, I'm Matt Harlan, and you're listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM.
Welcome to another edition of the Progressive Forum. The Progressive Forum covers issues such as human rights, the environment, politics, and peace and justice, in addition to presenting news, commentary, and a weekly calendar of events.
This is KPFT in Houston, the program's Progressive Forum. I'm Wally James. We have a special program this evening. We'll be playing audio from a talk and interview with journalist Rachel Maddow. It was presented by Randall Morton in the Progressive Forum Speaker Series. Rachel will be talking about her book, Prequel, An American Fight Against Fascism. This is recorded at the Congregation Emmanuel on June 13th.
Thank you so much for being here. I love Texas. I love Houston. I love this city every time I come here. First of all, just between us, do not quote me. It is always fun to visit kind of a blue dot in a red state. It's fun. There's energy. Everybody knows what the stakes are. But also, I just love that Houston has always had a little swagger. And I've always really felt at home here, so I'm grateful to be here. All right, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to read a little thing from the book, and then I'm going to say a little thing, and then I'm going to talk to Randall, and then we've got some questions from you guys. So that's how it's going to go. And it's all very dark, and I apologize in advance, but y'all know why. So here we go. He was one of the most successful and celebrated industrialists on the planet. His anti-Semitism was rank and it was unchecked. He spewed it freely in private tirades among friends, family, close business cohorts, newspaper reporters, or pretty much anybody within earshot. In the office, in private chats, in interviews, at dinners, even on camping trips. A close friend wrote in his diary after witnessing one late night round the campfire diatribe, quote, "Ford attributes all evil to Jews, or to the Jewish capitalists. Henry Ford even ordered his engineers to forgo the use of any brass in his Model T automobile. He called brass a, quote, Jew metal. Ford said, wherever there's anything wrong with a country, you'll find the Jews on the job there. He blamed a vast and inchoate Jewish conspiracy for inciting his workers and his stockholders to demand that he share any more of the expansive Ford Motor Company profits with them. He blamed Jews for the gold standard. He blamed Jews for the advent of the Federal Reserve Bank. He blamed Jews for ruining motion pictures in America. Henry Ford blamed Jews for ruining popular music. He blamed Jews for ruining baseball. And Henry Ford was hardly the only radical anti-Semite in the United States circa 1920. But in addition to his fortune and his famous name and his iconic automobile company, he had a megaphone that your average crazy uncle theorizer lacked. He had a paper, a newspaper called the Dearborn Independent, which he bought for a song in 1918. The paper was a big money loser in the beginning, with poor to middling circulation. Ford's own editorial harangues did little to draw new readers in. How many attacks on the man who beat Ford in the most recent Michigan U.S. Senate race did the public really want to read about? Oh, but Truman H. Newberry had stolen that election. One of the Independent's editorial staffers was a veteran of New York tabloid newspaper wars, and he had an idea. He wrote to Ford's right-hand man, "Find an evil to attack. Let's find some sensationalism." And lo, the answer landed unbidden not long after. A newly translated English edition titled The Protocols of the Meetings of the Learned Elders of Zion. The pamphlet was the work of rabidly anti-Semitic Russian fabulists who were mad at the Bolsheviks toppling the old Tsarist aristocracy. The czarists portrayed the Russian Revolution as not just a local affair, it was the early innings of a plot by a cabal of all-powerful Jewish schemers to take over the world. The Protocols was billed as the product of a surreptitious note-taker who was present at a top-secret meeting wherein these Jewish puppet masters had drawn up their strategy and tactics in detail. Now, there was no secret meeting, obviously. There was no secret plot. There was no surreptitious note-taker. The whole thing was a work of fiction, a very considered, very deliberate lie, and a very, very dangerous piece of propaganda. Henry Ford and his newspaper bore down on it with glee. They started a new weekly series in the Dearborn Independent based on the Protocols. It would end up being a 92-part weekly series. Every week for 92 weeks, headlines like these ran in Henry Ford's paper. The International Jew, the World's Problem. Jewish jazz, moron music, becomes our national music. The Perils of Baseball, too much Jew. These headlines were splashed onto the pages of Ford's paper, which was distributed in Ford Motor dealerships across the country. Ford also saw to the publication of this series in book form. It was titled The International Jew, and it ran to 4 volumes. Never mind that the Protocols had been exposed as make-believe in 1921, which was somewhere right in the middle of Henry Ford's anti-Semitic 90-something part newspaper series. Even after it was exposed as a fake, Ford's weekly International Jew essays continued without pause, and Ford Motor dealers kept tossing the latest issue of the Dearborn Independent onto the front seat of every newly purchased Model T in the country. Ford saw to it that the book version, the 4 volumes of the International Jew, were translated and published worldwide. 12 international editions, including one in German. And stick a pin in that. Of all the contributions Henry Ford made to this world, one of them was this OVRA, the most prolific, most sustained published attack on Jews the world had ever known. The German edition of Ford's book had landed in the hands of one particularly gifted propagandist. When Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf was published in 1925, he appeared to lift not just ideas, but whole passages from Henry Ford's publications. The first edition of Mein Kampf extolled Henry Ford by name. It said, "It is Jews who govern the stock exchange forces of the American Union. Every year makes them more and more the controlling masters of the producers in a nation of 120 million. Only a single great man, Ford, to their fury, still maintains full independence." Hitler, by this point, had already mulled sending some German shock troops to major American cities to aid in what he hoped would be Ford's run for the presidency in 1924. When a reporter from the Detroit News showed up at Nazi Party headquarters in Munich in December 1931 to interview Hitler, she had a series called 5 Minutes with Men in Public Eye. When she sat down to interview Hitler and looked around his office, she was surprised to find hanging on the wall behind Hitler's desk a large framed portrait of Henry Ford. Hitler explained to the newspaper woman, gesturing at his portrait of America's most famous anti-Semite. He explained to the reporter, quote, "I regard Henry Ford as my inspiration." The reporter asked Hitler that day why he was anti-Semitic, and he said without hesitation, "Somebody has to be blamed for our troubles." So the great thing about conspiracy theories is that they are undisprovable. They don't require facts to prove them, and you are not allowed to use facts to disprove them. And why is that? Because it's a conspiracy. It's secret. It's a secret plan. We are not allowed access to the real facts. And so therefore, there are no facts that can be brought to bear on that discussion. That means that anybody who does bring facts to the conversation is suspect, right? Oh, that's just what they'd want you to believe. The real truth we're not allowed access to. This is a very handy dynamic, right? Because it means that reason and rational argument can't win. It also means the conspiracy can be anything. Just let your mind run wild. Make it as lurid and exciting and dark and sexy and elaborate as you want. Whatever revs you up, whatever gets your blood pumping, that can be it. It can't be disproven, so just go with your gut. Maximize the emotional charge that you get out of it. And once you have done that, feel free to unlock yourself from normal politics, because if you think about it, if it really is a secret conspiracy that's controlling the economy, that's controlling disease and healthcare, that's controlling the government, that's controlling the justice system, then there's no point in thinking or working logically about how to improve those things, right? There's no reason to engage constructively with, you know, filling potholes in your town or getting the quality of your drinking water protected or protecting people from a novel virus. There's no reason to work logically and in a principled, constructive way on anything the government is supposed to do. There's no use in trying to get the government to fix stuff if the government is just window dressing, if there's really an evil, unaccountable cabal, a deep state cabal that's secretly really pulling the strings. Conspiracy theories are designed to up the power of emotion, to reduce the power of reason, and to disempower you as a citizen. You just focus on the cabal, right? Focus on the one shadowy enemy that must be behind all the things that are wrong. And once you do that, you have laid the grounds for fascism, even in a modern state, right? The fascists' line to the public always sort of follow the same contours. This place, this nation used to be great, but now it is no longer great. It's been weakened by our enemies within, who are secretly powerful, who are pulling the strings. They frankly have stolen this place. They've left the real people of the real nation on the outside and powerless. And are we gonna take our country back? We have to fight to save our country, to make it great again. But how do we fight? Well, these internal enemies. You've heard these terrible, lurid stories about them. They're so bad, they're so evil, they're so powerful. Normal measures will be ineffective against them. We need to do something radical. We need to break some rules. We're certainly not going to handle this with normal politics. They've rigged the normal politics. No use using the political system. We're going to need to use other means. That's how it works. And then you're there, and then we're here. So in a moment like this, why spend time worrying about history, telling stories from history at a time when the news of the day is so alarming on so many days? The reason that I have been spending my time doing this is that for me, this has turned out to be kind of a cheat sheet. Just because this stuff it keeps happening, and it always happens it's not like never exactly the same, but it's always in a sort of similar way. Democracies do not fall exactly the same way, but they do fall to exactly the same kind of guy, making exactly the same kind of appeal about lost greatness and the enemy within and the need to be tough and break the rules and all of it. It's always the same thing. So yes, our politics right now has that in spades. And that is alarming, but it shouldn't necessarily be surprising. We are going through something that is a recurrent thing, both around the world and, it turns out, here in our country too. And that's not great, but it does mean we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time it comes up. Here's an example. You all know how our 2020 election ended. We all remember that. Exactly 100 years before our 2020 election, in Bologna, in Italy, politicians on the left won a regional election. And Mussolini and his fascists decided that they did not like that election result and they were going to reject it. And so they stormed the council building, they rioted, they killed 9 people, and it worked. The council was suspended, and that basically negated that election and made it so the center-left had not won. By the following year, by 1921, flush with that success in Bologna, they were doing it everywhere. And by then they had scaled it up. Opposition and left politicians were no longer, it wasn't just that they weren't being allowed to take their seats when they were elected, they were starting to be physically attacked. When they'd show up for their seats in parliament, they'd be physically run out of parliament. Their homes were burned down. And the important thing that happened there in Italy was not just that there was a violent movement on the far right. It was not just that Mussolini was the kind of man he is and the kind of leader that he was, telling the kind of tales he was telling. The important part of that was that the state couldn't stop it. The state was unable or unwilling to stop the violent extremist right from using violence to get their way instead. Whether or not the government really wanted to stop them, the whole country took a look at what happened there and said, oh, our government appears to be powerless to protect political rights, to protect the political process and the people who are participating in it. And once the state proves to be weak, it gets overrun by the emboldened forces that have been able to push it to unimaginable edges. But also, support for the state collapses, because who wants to stand up for something so weak and feckless? That Bologna attack happened in 1920. They started physically attacking individual opposition politicians in 1921. By 1922, the fascist groups in Italy marched toward Rome. And they did not mount a coup because they did not have to. Italy's king just handed Mussolini the government and named him prime minister because who was going to stop him? Better to side with him instead. And Mussolini tried to look like a normal politician for a couple of years, but it didn't stick. By 1924, he had murdered the head of one of the main opposition parties, and then he just cut to the chase, outlawed all the opposition parties, and abolished elections. The fascists were formed in Italy in 1919. Nazi Party was founded in Germany in 1920. Protocols of the Elders of Zion was published in the United States at that same time. Henry Ford immediately starts reprinting it in his newly purchased Dearborn Independent. By 1933, Hitler is the Chancellor of Germany. In 1933, a man named William Dudley Pelley forms a gigantic anti-Semitic armed fascist militia in the United States called the Silvershirts. By 1940, France is falling to Germany. Italy has joined the Nazis in World War II. And here in the United States, the wife of Charles Lindbergh, the famous pilot, her name was Anne Morrow Lindbergh, she's just published a new book called The Wave of the Future. Her book is all about how fascism is the glorious future for all of us. And it was the number one book in the country for that year. These winds blow the same for us here in this country as they have in other countries. We are not immune. We are exceptional in lots of ways, but not this one. And the upside of that is that we can learn from this history in other countries, and we can learn from our history contending with it here. And maybe we should, because now we really do have another political movement on the right in this country that is trying to get rid of our electoral system and our legal system and to make us more like the authoritarian regimes that they admire abroad. So, a few things that I have learned here from doing this work. We are not immune to these kinds of movements. These movements in our country have not just been fringe kooks. They've been some of the most powerful people in the country, including the most famous industrialist in the country, Henry Ford, the most famous celebrity and national hero in the country, Charles Lindbergh, the man who was the face of American sports in the world, Avery Brundage, the head of the American the Olympic Committee in 1936. The biggest media titan in the country at the time was Charles Coughlin. All of the most powerful people in all of these incredibly, incredibly important sectors were all totally on board with America's pro-Nazi fascist movement in the lead up to World War II. So it's not that we have never faced very powerful people with these bad ideas before. We have. Also, you can learn from our experience of this and from other countries' experience of this, that political opposition matters. Political opposition is often very difficult against movements like this, but it matters. And so does the political process. Democracy is a process. It is a system of rights and protections from tyranny. What the Italians learned in the early 1920s, what we are learning right now, is that if we do not fight to protect the specifics of that process, we will lose that process. The rule of law and democracy are not abstract things. They are human processes run by regular folks, including many people in this room. If we don't protect the process, we will lose it. The danger on the right in this country right now is not that they are running against the Democratic Party. It is that they are running against the democratic process. And that has consequences for us. It's not just a thing to say to scare one another. It means that the people who participate in the democratic process need our protection. We are not in a civil war. We are not facing mass violence in the streets. We are not taking up military arms against one another. Instead, they are picking people off one by one. Elections workers, witnesses in trials, judges, prosecutors, family members of those people, individual opposition politicians. They are picking them off one by one and terrorizing them. It's terrible for those people, but it also gives us our marching orders as a democracy, which is to protect those people. We need to protect the press. We need to protect the judiciary and the court system. We need to protect opposition politicians. We need to protect the people who are being scapegoated. We do have a cheat sheet from history for how to do this. I think if we choose to learn it and to let it help us, it can help us. But honestly, I think we need to learn it fast because it is past time to start building the barricades. We here in this room right now, here in Houston, we are alive and sentient at a time when there is an ascendant ultra-right in this country that is linked to the most powerful people and forces in politics, and it includes right-wing armed paramilitary groups and the denial of election results and mass disinformation and conspiracy theories and intimidation targeting minorities and Jews and the political opposition. And weirdly, it involves big, hot, sexy crushes on foreign authoritarian leaders. It also involves the use of force and violence to affect political outcomes. We are living it. That is a diagnostic of our time. For our descendants, for the next generations of Americans who come after us, what we do now in a time like that is what they are going to learn about us. What do you want to be able to brag to your grandkids about? What do you want to be able to tell people that you did in your country when you were here and alive when all this happened? It is not a lucky thing to live in an important time, but this is an important time. Thank you.
Well done. Welcome back. It's good to be with you again. Thank you for wearing your sneakers. It just makes us all feel more comfortable. I buy my sneakers every 11 years just for you. So, I want to pick up with your reading on Henry Ford. He is a shocking example of leaders pushing the public towards fascism, but it takes a public that's ripe for it, say from grievances from inequality or cultural change. What did you learn that might explain today's public support for Trump?
History doesn't repeat. I mean, it recurs a little bit. There's patterns, but it's never exactly the same thing. And I don't think there's any analogy in modern life to Germany under the Nazis, right, from 1933 to 1945. There's nobody who's a Nazi other than a Nazi. There's nobody who's Hitler other than Hitler. But there's all sorts of different types of fascists and authoritarians. And I wanted to read that piece about what Ford blamed Jews for, because I think it is actually does give us some insight. I mean, here's a man who is an industrial titan, who's got probably the best brand name of any brand name in the world, who runs this gigantic motor company, who's acclaimed, you know, is one of a member of the pantheon of industrial world history. And he's worried about Jew metal in his Model T and thinks that somehow baseball's being ruined by Jewish people. I mean, the pettiness and the ridiculousness of it is one thing, but it also shows you that that sort of conspiratorial thinking doesn't have to come from a place of want or powerlessness. It comes from a place of laziness, which is that I do not want to bother to understand complex systems. I would prefer to pick a convenient enemy and blame them for everything. And so it's tactical. I knew that Henry Ford was prejudiced. I knew that he was personally anti-Semitic, but I just thought it was kind of a vice. I thought it was something personal about him. I didn't realize his role as a global propagandist for this stuff and its effect. But I think it's important to recognize both its psychological thrills and its political function. It makes you feel like everything makes sense and everything is simple now. And also that nothing that you might do constructively as a citizen is worth it. And that combination of the kind of dopamine that you get from being told that you're in on the secret and also that you cannot constructively make manifest anything that you want in the world because the secret cabal is in control, the only thing you can do is try to root out the cabal. That's a very dangerous thing, and both sides of that accelerate over time.
When the former president was convicted by 12 normal jurors, I got more hopeful thinking about normal citizens you profiled in your book. If 12 normal jurors can see through the noise, American normal voters can see through the noise too. How do you see it?
One of the things that I'm working on right now in Ultra Season 2 is a conspiracy theory about, again, Jewish Americans that took hold in the United States Senate after World War II. And the thing that's bizarre about it, A, it had a lot of political consequences and it sustains this whole drama for all of Ultra Season 2, and I hope you'll listen. But the other thing that's weird about it is that the conspiracy theory is kind of like QAnon level weird. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the details of what the QAnon conspiracy theory involves, but it's a horror movie, right? It's not just, oh, there's a secret cabal of people who are plotting things for their own benefit against the rest of us. It's lurid. It is violent. It is like satanic. It's bloody. And it's like an action movie, right? Like somewhere between an action movie and a horror movie. And when conspiracy theories evolve, they tend to evolve in a way that is divorced from the facts, so they don't need to be constrained by things that actually happen. And they tend to follow the path of most excitement. Whatever gets people's juices flowing the most. And you get into a cycle once you've bought in a little bit, once you've decided, okay, there isn't a real government, instead there's a cabal and George Soros is whatever. Once you've bought into that, you start craving more and more of that revelation dopamine and more of that illicit thrill of learning this transgressive knowledge, that stuff that you're not supposed to know. And these conspiracy theories always go into these dark, bloody, sometimes sexualized, like lurid, literally unbelievable directions. And that has always been the case. And I didn't really know that about the kind of parallels to the QAnon stuff before I started looking into it. But it made me realize, finally, like, oh, this is why we have that feeling of Earth 1 and Earth 2. Because on Earth 1, if you are told something crazy about somebody in America doing a crazy thing, you would like a fact to base that on. So a little bit of evidence, I don't know, a link, perhaps. Something. And if you don't have that, then you don't believe the crazy assertion. But on Earth 2, There's no using facts, and there's no using evidence, because it's all secret. We're not allowed access to the real facts. And for them, the conspiracies get weirder and weirder and weirder. And it's not just that there were ballots we didn't expect in Fulton County. There's a dead Venezuelan dictator and an Italian military satellite, and it goes crazy. And it's because the emotional energy on the conspiratorial side of it drives you toward crazier and crazier and crazier things, while it is getting more and more emotionally exciting to the people who believe it. And so on Earth 1, we're both bored and bewildered. On Earth 2, they believe, and they are increasingly devoted to the weirder and weirder and weirder stuff they are hearing, to the point where it makes them hard to function in regular life and regular politics. They're so excited and so gratified by what they are learning because it feels secret and true. And that is a recipe for a cleave in society that's very hard to bridge. That's why people who are in the QAnon cult lose their families, and why people in families lose their QAnon family members. And it's a tragedy, and it's awful. But it's driven by, I think, the psychological rewards of those kinds of terrible political tactics.
I have some audience questions. They're all panicky. This is group therapy stuff. Okay.
This is a big group for group therapy.
Yeah. Harriet asks, if Trump wins, should we leave the U.S.? Mimi asks, if Trump wins, how are you and your MSNBC colleagues protecting yourselves? And Bob asks, how do you keep sane?
All versions of the same question, I suppose. First of all, if you're feeling worry about what's going to happen in the country, it's not an irrational thing. And don't spin yourself into a worse place by feeling bad about the fact that you're feeling worried. It's okay to feel worried. That said, don't feel worried alone. If you didn't come here with somebody tonight, maybe one of the people who you said hi to who's sitting near you is somebody you might introduce yourself to and talk to more. I think especially, you know, I've done lots of book tour events and speaking engagements. I've tried to go to as many red states as I could. I think people living in states that have Republican-dominated legislatures, as the Republican Party is getting really Trump-dominated. In particular, I am hearing from people a lot of despair, but I am also hearing that people's civic lives are waking up. This is not a time to live inside your phone. This is not a time to, yeah. It's not a time to just watch MSNBC, although please watch MSNBC. This is a time to make sure you know your neighbors and get in touch with family members who you're out of touch with. And if you don't have a book club, it's a good time to have a book club. And if there is a candidate who you support or an issue that you support that is going to be on the ballot, it is time. Don't think about doing it for the fall. You have to do it now. And I say that not only because of any likely electoral effect that will have. I don't know who your chosen candidates are. I say that because participating in a shoe leather activity, or at least an activity where you are calling people on the phone who you don't already know. I know sometimes people phone bank that way. Anything where you are actively trying to have an impact on what is going to happen in your country is going to be both good for your country and good for you. The cure to despondency is action. And so I would encourage you to find something to do. And the more worried you are, the more urgency I would put into trying to join something, to meet people, to make sure that you're connecting. And if you're not a joiner, and if you're shy, and if you're introverted, try to connect just to the people who are already in your own life, who maybe you're only seeing through texts. Maybe try calls. If you're only connecting with people through calls, maybe try meeting up. It's a good time to make personal connections. So I would say that for one. In terms of leaving the country, you do you. Nobody, I think, in good faith is going to tell anybody not to do something that they feel like they need to do to protect themselves and their family. But if it was up to me to give advice in such a moment, and clearly it's not, I would say your country needs you right now.
This is KPFT, Houston.
So let's get to your book. It begins with an aspiring Nazi who has a big footprint in Houston, the renowned architect Philip Johnson, with several buildings in town. I quote from your book, Johnson's assistant said, quote, he speculated he might end up being the American Hitler, that he felt the fate of this country rested on his shoulders. Could you share that story? I mean, it's just so unbelievable. It just still shakes me up.
So Philip Johnson, this is not a secret story, but given the number of people who know him for his architecture, the ratio between that and the number of people who know him for his fascism feels uncomfortably large. I feel like, know him for his architecture, but also know the fascism. So Philip Johnson was a very rich young man who fell in love with Nazism very early on. He loved in particular the aesthetics of it. The opening scene with Philip Johnson in the book includes him at a big Hitler rally in Germany. He came back to the United States and sought first to find America's Hitler and then ultimately to maybe try to be America's Hitler himself. Luckily, nobody liked him and nobody was willing to follow him anywhere. He first attached himself to Huey Long, the legendary governor and senator from Louisiana, fully convinced that, as many people in Huey Long's day were convinced, that he would be America's dictator. Huey Long was described in non-hyperbolic terms in his day as heading up a dictatorship in the state of Louisiana. FDR most feared running for re-election against Huey Long because he thought that Long was such a talented demagogue, and he feared the sort of rising tide of dictatorship and authoritarianism around the world. He thought if Long made a full force run for the presidency in 1936, FDR expected to lose to him. Huey Long never did that. He was assassinated in 1935, but the fact that Philip Johnson took himself from New York, bought a bunch of guns, designed a new pennant for his new fascist political party, and drove himself to Louisiana to attach himself to Huey Long tells you something about how people thought it was really possible to do it here. After Long died, Philip Johnson attached himself to Father Charles Coughlin, who was the most influential media figure of his day, and I would argue the most influential and most listened to right-wing American political figure, media figure ever in the history of the country. Coughlin had like 30 million people listening to him weekly at a time when we did not have 200 million people in the country. And he was preaching that his followers should form themselves into armed fascist platoons to go wage war against the U.S. government to fight the Jews and the communists. When Johnson attached himself to Coughlin, he brought back to the United States, to a parade venue in Chicago, some of the aesthetic and architectural detail that he'd so admired at this Potsdam rally that he went to and saw Hitler speak at. And he tried to build Charles Coughlin a backdrop for speaking at that rally that was a Hitler-worthy, Leni Riefenstahl-worthy backdrop. And luckily, again, Philip Johnson kind of sucked and didn't pull it off. And Father Coughlin was Canadian, so he couldn't run for the presidency himself, but he was running kind of a puppet guy for the presidency in 1936 after Huey Long had been killed. He picked another guy. Philip Johnson was supporting him, built him this Hitler backdrop to try to have these amazing rallies, and it all petered out, thank God. But Philip Johnson was a true believer. He only really recanted when it seemed like he was going to get arrested for sedition. He was so wealthy and so well connected that his family interceded directly with, I believe it was the Secretary of the Navy, to give him kind of a get out of jail free card from sedition, and after that he kept his nose clean.
The story that astounded me most. The curiosity of an advertising man, like me, uncovered a Nazi plot involving over 24 congressmen and senators taking money and direction from the Nazis. Can you share that, please?
So we're talking about a guy named Henry Hoke. And Henry Hoke is not a famous person, although I would love to make him famous with this book. The great thing about Henry Hoke is that he was a nobody guy. He was a regular citizen. Like, you think about American heroes and people who saved the country from fascism, and you kind of imagine, like, Iwo Jima, you know what I mean? Like, you imagine, like, guys in uniforms. Tough guys, or at least people who were, like, really brave and crusaders. Henry Hoke was a totally dorky, unfashionable, nebbishy ad guy. And his specialty was direct mail advertising. He was like a trade expert in, I think, like the insert cards that you put in magazines and stuff. Like, this was not a Marine general. He did have this area of expertise, though, and his son went to UPenn, and not long after he had been at UPenn, he called his dad and said, "I want to come home. I don't like it at school." And his dad said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, I don't like the political atmosphere. For one, we get this stuff shoved under our doors and our dorms every day. And it's fascist, it's pro-German, and it's anti-Semitic, and it's, I'm not into it. I don't like it here." And Henry Hoke went and visited his son and looked at the material, talked to some other dads who had some kids in other schools, talked to some professors at Penn, started looking around and realized, you know what? I might actually be the American hero for this moment. Because I am an expert in direct mail advertising. And this is direct mail advertising for fascism. This propaganda is well produced. I can tell how it's being produced. I can tell you from the quality of the paper and the way that it is targeted and the education level of the language in it and where it's turning up. He started realizing this was not just on college campuses. This stuff was turning up in dentist offices, insurance agents, government offices, all sorts of places were all getting this material that was very specifically targeted to where it was going. And he traced it to its source. He figured out where it was from, in part by tracing some of the addressing machines that had been used to put the labels on the material that was being mailed out. He recognized the typeset of the addressing machines. He knew it was a sort of out-of-date machine. He knew there were only 3 still at work in the United States. He could account for 2 of them, and then he found the 3rd, and then he figured out who was sending it. And what he had discovered was a multi-million dollar Nazi propaganda operation targeting the United States, run by the Berlin Foreign Office. It was the largest Nazi propaganda operation anywhere in the world outside Germany. And if you followed him a little bit further down the path, he then turned his direct mail advertising trade publication into like a scoop machine, like expose every week with what he had discovered. And ultimately where this led was to 24 members of Congress and United States senators who were working with a Nazi agent to send this stuff from the Foreign Office in Berlin, to send it out to the American people, not just through the direct mail stuff that he had discovered, but through their congressional offices, which meant they could send it out with no postage. Congressional franking, all billed to the American taxpayer. The copies, the envelopes, the postage, all paid for by the US government. And Henry Hoke exposed that because he was a dork. And he had this very specific area of expertise. You never know when your skills are going to be called upon by your country. Your country needs you. Our country needs all of us.
Don asks, why haven't these big stories in fascism in America been told before?
I have broadened my thoughts about this recently because of this new thing that I'm working on. Because for a long time, I thought this story that's in prequel, that was touched on in Ultra Season 1, I thought that I had found the big story about fighting fascism in modern American history that we'd forgotten about? All my answers when I've been asked things like this and before were really specific to this story. Oh, well, you know, the senators who were implicated put pressure on the Justice Department to drop the case, and the president was friends with one of the senators who was in trouble, and so he ordered the Justice Department's evidence to be submarined, and the judge died in the trial, and so there was a mistrial. Like, I had all these answers to this that was very specific to this story. Then I started working on another one of them. And Ultra Season 2 is about another one of these stories, about a real authoritarian threat linked to foreign dictatorships abroad, where sitting members of Congress, people with a lot of political power, are implicated, and brave, totally forgotten Americans stand up to them and kind of stop them in the nick of time. And so now I'm worried that I've found a trend. I mean, I'm hoping there isn't going to be a season three of Ultra. I'm hoping it's just these two. But the commonality is that it's not really in anybody's interest, I think, to tell these stories. If you were the member of Congress who got caught working for a Nazi agent, you don't want this story told. If you were the Nazi agent, this is not the most important thing that happened in your life in the last 80 years. And if you were the Americans who fought them, I think we're disinclined to hear these stories because we know how it works out, right? We're still a republic, we're still a democracy. They didn't get us. And so looking back on stories like that retrospectively, that makes us think like, oh, maybe it wasn't such a big deal. But you go back and you look at this stuff contemporaneously, and you see these 4-inch headlines on the front page of every paper in the country in January 1940 about Coghlan's Christian Front militia being arrested for sedition, and the piles and piles of explosives that they had, and the plans they had to murder 12 congressmen, starting with the Jews, and the bombs they planned to set off a violent revolution, starting in New York City and in other major cities where they had the National Guard sort of primed to help out once it would go. And you see, you know, the head of the FBI himself showing up at the press conference to announce that these arrests had happened. And you see the country absolutely convulsed with worry over these things. You see the sedition trial, these 30 defendants brought in, and the Justice Department laying out the evidence, not just that they wanted a fascist dictatorship here, but that they were working in cahoots with the Nazi government that we were fighting in the war at the time. And you see the national freakout about it. And you realize, you know what? The fact that we know it ended up okay and we survived as a country is not the whole truth of this. The whole truth of this has to include how dangerous it was in the moment, and therefore how crucial it was that Americans worked to stop it. And that is where we are now. Because I fully believe that there will not be an authoritarian takeover of the United States government. I fully believe that we will keep our democracy. But I know it is not inevitable. I know it will only happen because Americans will stand up for it. And so we need to learn these stories about how important, risky, brave, and interesting, honestly, it can be to fight these fights. We need to know that people who went before us did this, and that's why we have the republic that we have today, because we're the next generation that has to do what they did.
So I have a Texas question. You've discussed the red flags for noticing encroaching fascism, and one of them is going after scapegoats. And here in Texas, we have a government that's scapegoating immigrants, blacks and browns, LGBTQ folks, and more. What is your advice for Texans?
I would never deign to give Texas advice. I know Texas well enough to know that. If you don't mind, if I turn it back to you, I mean, where do you look for hope? Where do you see silver linings? Where do you see people doing good work against that in Texas?
I see hope in that I think Democrats realize the situation is urgent. Winning a statewide office seems to be the main thing. The last time that happened was 1994. I think Colin Allred. He's already close. And to be this close, this far out for election, I think is good reason for hope.
Electoral politics are important. Electoral politics are how we get power in this country, and that's the way it should be. It's not the only form of power, though, and scapegoating works by excusing the people who have power from having to deliver, because you can always say, you can always excuse your incompetence by blaming the cabal, by blaming the enemy within, by blaming these secretly powerful people who we all want to dislike as being the real reason that things are bad. I think it's helpful to know that as a political tactic, because I actually think that the vast majority of people, once they understand that a political tactic is being used on them, nobody likes to be used, nobody likes to have their chain yanked. I think when you debunk conspiracy theories, or try to, when you criticize people for out of bounds, inhuman, indecent, ungentlemanly behavior in the public sphere, when you report that people are lying, when you tell the truth about the way things really are, you are likely not going to reach people who are committed partisans of the side that is trying to get one over on people. But you are ultimately, if you are persistent and responsible about that, you are ultimately going to reach reasonable people. And you will move the reasonable center. And there is a reasonable center. And the average voter, right? There's no such thing as an average voter, so I'll say the median voter, is a person who's not an extremist of any kind, and who may be entertained by or momentarily seduced by different forms of extremism. But if they see that there is something being offered to them in politics that isn't conspiratorial, that isn't extreme, that is practical, ultimately you are making that an option that still can be chosen in your state. So I know that's an unsexy way to approach it, but working on electoral politics matters. Calling out scapegoating as a political tactic matters. But I'll just also say one other piece of it, which is scapegoating has this political purpose. Scapegoating also ruins and risks the lives of the people who are scapegoated. And they need your help. They need your support. They need your visible support. And that is something, the more privilege you have, the more support you have to offer. And that is something that can be life-changing for the person you are offering to back up and the person you are willing to stand in front of when they come for them. It will also be life-changing for you. And so I would just say think about it in two different ways. Think about it in terms of its political power and calling it out, but also think about what you can do. If you see people in your community and in your state who are being persecuted, who are being scapegoated, who are being blamed for things that they do not need to be blamed for, figure out what you can do to show support for that community to other people who wouldn't necessarily expect that you would support them. I grew up in the AIDS activist movement, and in the height of the AIDS crisis, it was very powerful for those of us in the gay community to stand up for ourselves and be heard and speak on our own terms and defend ourselves and our community. But there is nothing like the power of straight people in that moment standing up and saying, us too.
Vanity Fair reported that Steven Spielberg optioned your ultra story on the Great Sedition Trial of 1944. If that's correct, what can you share?
Do you believe that? It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
Everybody knows who Tony Kushner is from Angels in America. Tony Kushner is one of my heroes, and he is writing the screenplay along with Danny Strong, who's another amazing screenwriter, and they are writing it right now. And Steven Spielberg plans to direct it, and so that will become a movie at some point. It's amazing.
Uh, last question. What have you learned from responses on your book tour? What are you learning about the country?
At every stop, I have been asked the question that you guys asked about being worried. And I do feel like connecting with people and making sure that you've got other human beings in your life who you regularly look in their eyes is an important thing. When the danger in our country is coming from people who are telling you that among us is an internal enemy, that subhuman, vermin, needs to be exterminated, right? Needs to be taken care of once and for all. When those are the kinds of words that are being used to describe our fellow Americans, we need to make sure that as a population, we've got resistance to that. And one sure way to be incapable of believing that any of your fellow Americans is subhuman is to reach them as a human, is to talk to them face to face, is to be eye to eye with people, even with people you disagree. It matters. It matters. And we're already seeing, it's not hypothetical, we're already seeing what it is for people to be personally threatened by this movement. We see it in Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss. We see it in Fani Willis. And we saw it, obviously, on January 6th, but we see it with all of the members of the January 6th investigatory committee in Congress needing 24-hour security. The terroristic violence against the opposition, against journalists, against anybody who's standing in their way has begun. That means that the response to it must begin. And the people who are being targeted need standing up for. But it means that the responsibility is also on all of us to stand up for the people who are already being targeted, to back them up, to fund their legal defense funds, to stand up and make sure there's a political cost to people who attack them in a way that is not called for. I think we're afraid of something that we imagine is coming. It is worth worrying about what we've got right now as a country, but it's not some distant thing we have to anticipate it. We're living in it now, and that means we can act now. And whatever you find to be wrong in your country right now, and you find to be worrying about how people are being treated and targeted, figure out a way to help them. Action is the cure to despair.
We've been listening to Rachel Maddow's interview with Randall Morton from the Progressive Forum Speaker Series. I'm Susan Phillips in for Wally James. Coming up this Saturday, activist, singer-songwriter David Rovix will be playing at a house concert in Houston. For more information, you can call 832-744-6292. Again, for more information on the David Rovix concert, call 832-744-6292. Until then, here's a song by David Rovix, What If You Knew? Stay tuned for Jacqueline Batiste with People of Earth, coming up next.
If you knew the Earth was dying, if they said this on the news, if they would clarify the picture instead of seeking to confuse, if you could see the ice caps melting, if you could watch the oceans rise, if you could see the consequences right before your eyes, if you knew the kids were dying, if you could look inside the river where their food comes from, filled with cyanide, if you could hear the parents pleading, if they were looking right at you, if you could see the anguish in their hearts, what if you knew? If you knew the bombs were falling, if they showed them hit the ground, if you could see the bodies flying, if you could hear the sound, if you could see the rubble where the hospital once stood, if you saw the child's lifeless limbs, would you hold them if you could? If you knew that they were lying, every time they spoke, for every laser-guided pinprick, there were lives lost in the smoke. If instead of just the generals, they had doctors too to describe the carnage of the cluster bombs, what if you knew? Such a familiar sight to anyone who's seen the photos when they came in and let in the light. shone in the contest of faces that showed us the bones and the skin. Look upon that little girl and multiply it by